This time I will ask the clerk to call this morning's calendar.
Calendar for the Supreme Court of California holding a special session in Redding, California on Wednesday, October 5th at 9 a.m. is as follows. Case number S121009, sequel plaintiff and respondent, the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company defendant and appellant. For the appellant, Mr. Escher III.
Ready, Your Honor.
And for the respondent, Mr. Eckert.
Ready.
Case number S123074, people plaintiff and respondent, the Jarmont Mall Smith, defendant and appellant. For the appellant, Mr. Marshall.
Ready, Your Honor.
For the respondent, Ms. Newton. Case number S040703, the people respondent, the James Robinson Jr. appellant. For the appellant, Ms. Marr. And for the respondent, Ms. Brody.
We'll proceed initially in the matter of People versus R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, hearing first from Mr. Escher. And I want to indicate that we're pleased to have sitting with us by assignment as a Justice Pro Tem of the Supreme Court, the Honorable William Bedsworth, Associate Justice of the 4th Appellate District, Division 3, sitting by assignment. Mr. Escher.
Good morning, Your Honors, and I want to thank the Court for this opportunity to address this historic session. As I was listening to the questions from the students and the responses from the Court, I couldn't help but think what an appropriate and fascinating case the one that I'm going to present today is with respect to the jurisprudential issues that the students asked and that Your Honors responded to. The issues having to do with the role of precedent, the importance of predictability in the legal system, the deference to federal decisions regarding the interpretation of federal law, the role of the courts in policy making, and the relationship between a court and the language of a statute. The Court of Appeal majority below admitted that, quote, we decline to let promotion be the tail that wags the dog, end quote. And as Your Honors all know, the issue in this case is the meaning of the term promotion.
Mr. Escher, to get to the heart of the issue, given the fact that you have not that much time, and
yes,
it's a very difficult and close case, focusing immediately on Health and Safety Code Section 118950, Subdivision B, as we, as the parties and members of the bench know, the legislature, through that statute, has prohibited the non-sale distribution of tobacco products on at any public property. Well, of course, apart from this particular statute, there is a different statute which is referred to as the so-called safe harbor provision. And that provision states that there is an exception to the statute prohibiting non-sale distribution of tobacco products at public property when the tobacco company leases a booth or whatever on property leased for a private function, and the tobacco company denies access to minors. I gather, Mr. Escher, that it's really the so-called safe harbor provision that you or your client relies on in urging that, no, you did not violate the law, and the attorney general was wrong in bringing a lawsuit against a tobacco company after your company, or your client, rather,
yeah,
in 1999, at six separate events, gave away cigarettes, etc.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, and I'm sorry for the lengthy question. No, I would like your response to why do you think that, from your perspective, the safe harbor provision really helps you out?
Oh, it does really help us out, Your Honor. Our position is that the proper interpretation of Health and Safety Code Section 118950 F would allow for the distribution of free cigarettes if there's a lease of the public property for a private function and there's a licensed security guard which excludes minors from the distribution location.
Then, of course, the first hurdle you have to overcome in that argument is the counter-argument by the Attorney General, who has strenuously argued that the word lease doesn't mean, you know, a temporary permit. How do you get around that?
Well, I do have an answer to that question, Your Honor, and it's Public Resources Code Section 6501, which establishes that in connection with the authority to lease public grounds, which is exactly the situation we have here, a lease includes a, quote, permit, easement, or license, end quote. And the contracts at stake here would at least amount to that, a permit, easement, or license, because all that really means, Your Honor, is that there's a contractual ability to use the property. The reality is, Your Honor, that the state of California does not typically lease out the a public ground like, for example, the Los Angeles County Fairgrounds in something like a 10 or 15-year written lease, which enables somebody to exclude everybody from the property. It includes permit, easement, or license. So I think
the legislature didn't say that, did it? The legislature didn't say that. The legislature just said lease, correct?
The legislature said lease in the context of Health and Safety Code Section 118950, but it's a lease of public property. The definition under Public Resources Code Section 6501 is that a lease in connection with the authority to lease public grounds includes a permit, easement, or license. So if you put the two together, one refers to lease of public grounds, and then you go to the Public Resource Code Section 6501, you see that's defined as permit, easement, or license.
Mr. Escher, is there ambiguity in the statute? And to the extent there is, do general principles require that we resolve the ambiguity in favor of the person or entity sought to be governed by it rather than in favor of the government?
Well, Your Honor, I guess my first response is I don't think it is ambiguous. I think it was incorrectly determined by the by both of the courts below. I suppose there were those who would say that if they've got it wrong twice, it's ambiguous. But I think it's not ambiguous, but that if it is ambiguous, it should be interpreted in a way that is consistent, certainly, with the good faith interpretation that we've got here. So that in a sense, I think it's not ambiguous because permit, easement, or license clearly encompasses the contracts here.
But you're urging that there is a clear enough legislative intent here that it is fair to resolve the ambiguity in favor of that overriding.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would take it both in terms of the statutory language by using the permit, easement, or license language from the Public Resources Code section, plus the legislative history that we pointed out, where there's a clear indication in the Senate report that it was anticipated that exactly these sorts of, you know, walled-off or tented kind of environments were anticipated to be within the statutory exemption in 118950F.
Why wouldn't the legislature, if it intended to have identical safe harbor provisions for public property versus private property, why wouldn't the legislature use identical language?
Well, I guess my first reaction, Your Honor, would be that the reference to the safe harbor on private property is a later amendment. If that's what Your Honor is asking, or are you asking about the exclusion for property that's leased for a private function? I think those would be two different questions.
Well, in other words, if, as I understand it, your view would be that the safe harbor provisions accomplish the same result, whether it's public or private. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor.
And my question to you is, if that was the legislature's intent, why wouldn't the same language be used for both safe harbor provisions?
Maybe I am misunderstanding Your Honor's question. And I think that if we look at subsection F, the first sentence deals with public grounds where minors are prohibited by law. That's not this case. Nobody's suggesting that the Los Angeles County Fairgrounds are an environment in which minors are prohibited by law. The next sentence basically deals with our situation where there's a public ground which is leased for a private function where minors are denied access by a peace officer or licensed security guard on the premises. That's the situation that we're dealing with here. Now, of course, there's a later subsection which was added, which is 118950G, which deals with a completely different situation, which is to say private property, because the statute was subsequently amended to preclude the distribution of free cigarettes on private property as well as public property.
Counsel, promotion is not defined in the federal law, and it appears to me that you're taking a broad reading of what that means. Would you concede, however, that the state retains certain police powers that are not clearly preempted, such as the sale of cigarettes to minors, the enforcement of non-smoking ordinances, and so forth?
Okay. I think the answer is yes, Your Honor, although I would quibble with a couple of the characterizations in the first part of the question. I don't think that we're interpreting promotion broadly. I think that promotion is, although it's not defined in the context of 15 U.S.C. Section 1334B, it was previously in Section 1337 of Title 15 of the United States Code, and that use of the term promotion was interpreted by the Federal Trade Commission to include free samples, which I think is really a very persuasive point that over a very long period of time, the term promotion was used in Section 1337 and was interpreted by the agency responsible for administering that statute to include free samples. And of course, Your Honor, we think that all the dictionary definitions are on our side as well as common sense. And I'd also point Your Honors to the Health and Safety Code Section 118950 itself, because it makes a reference to, in subsection 9, it says tobacco product advertising and promotion are an important cause of tobacco use among children. More money is spent advertising and promoting tobacco products than any other consumer product. And then it goes on in subsection 10 to state, distribution of tobacco product samples and coupons is a recognized source by which minors obtain tobacco products. Now, of course, I'm not necessarily agreeing with those legislative findings, but what I am saying is that if you look at 9 and 10 together, there's a clear indication that even in the context of the Health and Safety Code section, they anticipated that free samples would be considered to be tobacco promotions because, of course, they're not tobacco advertisements. And of course, even if they were, the Federal Labeling and Advertising Act preempts advertising and promotion. So I think it's really quite clear that the term promotion there is recognized even in the statute.
Does promotion include distribution?
Well, I guess what I would say is, Your Honor, is that some distributions are promotions and some distributions are not promotions. I think a sale is not a promotion. A sale is a sale, and it's quite clear from what the U.S. Supreme Court has told us in Lorillard versus Riley that the state police powers with respect to sale and use are for the most part preserved despite the fact that you've got the preemptive effect of the Labeling and Advertising Act.
And if it's a distribution without, if it's a free distribution, is that within the state's regulatory power? Free distribution, not a sale.
I think the answer is that would not be within the state's power if the regulation was focused on tobacco promotions and the regulation were based on smoking and health. So, for example, if the legislature passed a law that said there will be no free samples of any products on public property, that wouldn't be based on smoking and health, so that could be regulated in that fashion. I think it's even arguable, Your Honor, that if the state passed a rule that said that there shall be no distributions of tobacco products on public grounds, that would not be preempted either, because then it would be focused on distribution and it would not be with respect to promotion. But here we have a statute that is focused only on promotional distributions, and it's quite clear from 15 U.S.C. Section 1334B and the interpretation of that statute in Cipollone and then in Lorillard versus Riley, that advertising and promotion mean advertising and promotion. And the argument that my opponent has been making, that you need to look to the context or you need to look to the purpose of the statute, that approach has been rejected by Justice O'Connor's majority opinion in Lorillard versus Riley, because Justice O'Connor squarely considered the issue of whether the location of the location in which cigarettes are either advertised or promoted could be regulated by the states within its police power, because that wouldn't interfere with the purpose of the Labeling Act. And Justice O'Connor said, no, I can't square that with the statutory language. And the statutory language there was all advertising, and here it's all promotion. It's really very literal, Your Honor. It says advertising and promotion. And I think that to use any notion of statutory context or statutory purpose to override the language as clear as that is really very inappropriate in terms of the court's role vis-a-vis the decision that Congress made 36 years ago. Maybe there are people who think that what Congress did 36 years ago wasn't a good idea, and that promotion shouldn't be included in the preemptive ambit of Section 1334B. But that word is in there, and it needs to be respected. I don't think that you can take sampling out of the word promotion any more than you could take the word chair out of the term furniture.
So you say that promotion has one plain meaning, and it's not ambiguous, and we don't have to look to any other aspects of the statutory scheme?
I think that in this case the answer is yes. There may be some context in which there's an overlap between something which is promotional in character and something which is, for example, in the nature of a use. That's a possibility. But in this case, we've got something that's right square in the middle of the definition of promotion, and it's been recognized to be such not only by the FTC in connection with the Labeling Act itself, but also the Health and Safety Code section considers it to be a promotion. The Attorney General himself referred to the changes in the sampling procedures in connection with the Pomona Fairground to be a change in promotional practices in this very case. So I think there's a lot of recognition that a free sample in a context like this one is a promotion. There may be difficult cases in which there's a different kind of activity that's on the edge of the term promotion. This one's not on the edge. It's right in the middle.
Mr. Escher, I would like for a moment to take you away from the preemption issue, which we have been discussing in the past few seconds. I still have a couple of questions pertaining to the first issue. Let's assume, of course, solely for the purposes of oral argument, that we agree with you on your interpretation of the word lease as used in the statute. That still leaves you with a hurdle. Your view is that because your client, in renting this particular booth at the various fair events, excluded minors from gaining entrance to the booth where free cigarettes were being distributed, that you complied with the safe harbor provision. Of course, the Attorney General says, just excluding minors from a particular booth that one is renting from the promoter of an event is not sufficient. According to the Attorney General, the minors have to be denied access to the entire event. The answer that I would like you, the question that I would be asking you is, given the contention of the Attorney General and taking a look at the express intent by the legislature, where the legislature said it was extremely concerned about the horrid effects of smoking on the health of Californians in general, and particularly concerned about young children getting addicted to smoking. Given these circumstances, why shouldn't this court agree with the Attorney General's position that, given the express declarations by the California legislature pertaining to smoking, et cetera, et cetera. Why shouldn't this court hold that the minors would have to be excluded from the entire event and not, as you have urged this court to hold, only from the particular booth that your client would be renting?
Mr. Escher, you may respond to the question, but your time then will be up, assuming you wish to save 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm relying on the language of the statute, Your Honor, and I don't think that it would be appropriate to take the public policy concerns about the dangers of smoking and effectively read the safe harbor out of the statute. And if you look at the first sentence of subsection F, that's really the section that deals with the exclusion of minors from the entire public property. That's one where minors are prohibited by law. Those are the ones where minors are excluded from the entire public property, like the Los Angeles Fairgrounds. Of course, that doesn't happen. And in practical terms, you'd be reading the statutory exemption out of practical reality. But, Your Honor, I would really look to the language, which says, public grounds leased for private functions where minors are denied access. So if there are public grounds leased for a private function, here the private function is the distribution of cigarettes, and I want to argue and urge once again that it was only to individuals who could prove they were already existing smokers and had to go through a three-level inquiry to assure that they were at least 21 years old, that's the exclusion that applies here, and that the first sentence is the one that deals with the exclusion of minors from the entire property, and the second one is the one where they're denied access by a peace officer or licensed security guard on the premises. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Escher. We'll hear now from Mr. Eckert.
Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, may it please the Court.
Mr. Eckert, before you go into anything Certainly. Further, would you be so kind as to respond to the answer that Mr. Escher gave? According to Mr. Escher, taking a look at the safe harbor provision, the plain language really helps his position because, as you know, and as Mr. Escher quoted, under that particular provision, the prohibition on on-sale distribution of tobacco products does not apply to public property, quote, leased for private functions where minors are denied access by peace officers. And as Mr. Escher pointed out, you take a look at the plain language of the statute, and on its face, it does seem to support Mr. Escher's position that it was sufficient to simply deny access to the minors pertaining to entrance to the particular booth leased by the tobacco company.
Justice Kennard, the exception that is provided, or the safe harbor that's provided by subdivision F, needs to be construed, we believe, narrowly so that the exception doesn't swallow the rule. The rule the legislature laid down was no sampling on public property unless the public property had been leased. In other words, leased for private functions, taken out of the public domain, essentially,
Let's assume, I just wanted to get to the issue, let's assume for purposes of oral argument that we disagree with your interpretation of the term lease, so let's put that behind us. Let's focus on the question I asked pertaining to leaving aside lease, blah, 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 where minors are denied access by a peace officer.
Well, it was stipulated below that minors were denied access. We don't disagree with the fact that they were denied access from the sampling booths or tents. But in order to understand how these events occurred, these were car races, street fairs, and other events held on public property where the event was the race, the car race, the motorcycle championship, the street fair in which there was entertainment and other things, assuming that that would be what occurred on seven blocks of Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles County. The private function, the argument that this was a private function occurring within the booth, I think, again, it would make the exception swallow the rule. The private function is not the sampling that the legislature intended by private functions when a private party leases a public building or other discrete recognizable piece of public property and invites members of a club, members of a family, persons who are related to one another, members of a trade association, to come to that private event, and they exclude minors from that private event, cigarette sampling could occur. The legislature was trying to draw a very narrow exception and wasn't suggesting, and I don't believe in any way that cigarette sampling could be the private event for which the public grounds or public building was leased.
Well, Mr. Eckert, to what extent is the language really clear here, or to what extent does it contain various ambiguities, whether it's a private function or access or promotion? And to the extent there is ambiguity, do we construe that ambiguity in favor of the government, in favor of overall legislative intent, or in favor of the party sought to be regulated?
Mr. Chief Justice, I believe in this case, because, again, this is the exception to the broader rule. The broader rule is a matter of protecting the public health. The exception needs to be construed narrowly in the cases that we've cited in our briefs. And construing it narrowly means that ambiguities would be construed in favor of the government, because otherwise the purpose of the statute to prevent cigarette sampling as a means by which the legislature at least concluded was a way in which minors often obtain cigarettes, that it would defeat that overall purpose if ambiguities were construed against the government.
On another issue, the defendant asserts that you, the Attorney General, delayed filing this lawsuit and thereby intentionally let the statutory penalties accumulate. What is your response?
Well, our response, Your Honor, is we did not do that, obviously. When we filed the complaint, which was in June of 2001, we didn't, at that point, the only event at which we knew Reynolds had provided free samples had occurred in February of 1999. We didn't know that they had provided free samples in February of 1999 at the Pomona Raceway until after all the other events had occurred. We were not aware of the other events until discovery was commenced in our case involving the distribution of free samples at Pomona in 1999, and then coupons, which is not an issue in this case, coupons for $1 off two packs, which were distributed in February of 2000. We didn't know about those other events. The complaint, which is in the record, does not allege any other events besides the two events that occurred at Pomona, only one of which, the February 1999 event, is an issue before the court. We were not aware of the other events, in other words, until after the complaint was filed.
Was there any effect of your office's attempt to negotiate, I think, with regard to the motorcycle race event, the type of tent that would be permitted, any aspect of that undermines the position of your office or not? Is that irrelevant?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. As Your Honor probably knows, my declaration is part of the record in this case, in which I explained how the circumstances of negotiating with R.J. Reynolds over the configuration of sampling booths that had taken place at an event on private property, the Sonoma Raceway, which is now called Infineon Raceway, a private location where Reynolds had essentially passed out free samples of cigarettes in much the same way we discovered only later they had distributed free samples at Pomona in February of 1999. The negotiations over those events, over how they would configure sampling booths on private property, only occurred after all these events. The last of the events in issue in this case occurred, I believe, in October of 1999. The negotiations with Reynolds occurred in November of 1999. We were not aware of those events.
The special issue of a federal preemption and whether or not we should read the term promotion under the Federal Act broadly or narrowly. Two cases concern me because they seem to address almost an identical issue that we're concerned with, and yet they go the other way. First is the Rockwood case out of the Vermont Supreme Court, which held that the federal law preempted a ban on sales or giveaways within 1,000 feet of a school. And the Jones case out of the Eighth Circuit, which also dealt with a law that banned giveaways in exchange for free food, or when you bought cigarettes, they gave you free food. And yet the courts in those two instances said that those state laws were preempted. Why isn't the same here?
Well, Your Honor, for one thing, the Rockwood case was decided before the U.S. Supreme Court decided Lorillard versus Riley. The Jones versus Vilsack case, the Eighth Circuit case, was decided after Jones versus Riley, Lorillard versus Riley. But as we explain in the briefs, the analytical process that both of those courts engaged in was essentially the same analytical process which Reynolds suggests in this case, which is that the court put on textual blinders and look only at the word promotion and go from what does the word promotion mean in the dictionary and in marketing text, and if it means that it includes free sampling, Reynolds wins. Our perspective, which is I think the correct analytical approach which the U.S. Supreme Court followed in Lorillard versus Riley, relying significantly on the Medtronic decision, Judge Stevens' decision in Medtronic a few years earlier, that you don't just look at the preemption provision, you look at the intent of Congress as expressed in the structure and purposes of the federal act, not just at the preemption provision. And our view is that if you look at the structure and purposes of the act, you realize that Congress took some very bold steps to protect the public health in 1969. It banned ads for cigarettes on television and radio. It also did expand the prevention provision. I'm not suggesting that it didn't expand it. Both the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Cipollone as well as Lorillard indicated that the 1969 preemption provision was broader than it was in 1965. Nonetheless, Congress did not define promotion. And when it talked about in that act about free sampling, it talked about it in the context of a sale, not in the context of a promotion. And so it's our view that those are textual hints or contextual hints, if you will, in the structure and purpose of the act. Ignoring legislative history and Senate reports, just looking at the act itself, that Congress in Lorillard, the Supreme Court in Lorillard versus Riley made it very clear that you have to look at those clues. And despite what Mr. Escher represented, I believe that there are indications in the Lorillard opinion that specifically say, where Justice O'Connor says, we are aided in our interpretation by considering the predecessor provision and the circumstances in which the current provision was adopted. And also, we're not at liberty, in responding to Justice Stevens' dissent in Lorillard versus Riley, Justice O'Connor says, we are not at liberty to pick and choose which provisions in the legislative scheme we will consider, but must examine the FCLAA as a whole. And I'm respectfully to my opponent's position, that's what they're doing. They're doing just the opposite of that. They're looking only at what does promotion mean, and then immediately, as did the Jones case, going to the dictionary and saying promotion, free sampling, free sampling is a means of promotion. And I think that Justice Carney,
I have
a question.
For you
I was just
going,
my only point was that when Congress talks about free sampling in the act, it references it in connection with sales. And everyone agrees, including nine justices in Lorillard, that sales and use regulation is within the ambit of the state's authority, remains in the ambit of the state's authority despite preemption.
Mr. Eckhart, I would like to follow up on a question that I think was first started by Justice Chin and then followed up by the Chief Justice, relating to the nearly $15 million fine that the trial court assessed against the tobacco company. And I may have missed something in your answer, and I wonder if you would be kind enough to fill in the gaps that I think I may have missed. As you recall, defendant in the trial court argued that it had really tried in good faith to comply with the provision in section 118950. The record shows there was an exchange of letters between Reynolds, the tobacco company, and your office, that of the Attorney General, concerning the tobacco company's plan to give out free cigarettes at the auto races in Pomona on, I think, what was it, November 12th or 14th. In any event, defendant company told the Office of the Attorney General that the tobacco company planned to locate its booth inside an opaque tent and, according to the company, with no signage of any nature on the outside of the tent. defendant then added, and I'm quoting, telling the Attorney General, we will, of course, continue to guard rigorously access to the tent so that only smokers 21 years of age or older can enter. Your office then responded, quote, this addresses our concerns about the booth as a locus of tobacco advertising and as a source of youth exposure. Paren, visual and auditory, end of paren, to free sampling activity. We appreciate your making this important change in your marketing and promotional practices. The trial court, when this argument by the tobacco company was made, telling the trial court, we, in good faith, after checking with the Attorney General, were led to believe that what we planned to do was quite all right. And lo and behold, a couple of years later, we are being sued by the Attorney General, and we wind up with a fine of $15 million. Given the trial court's ruling that good faith was totally irrelevant, what do we do with our cases, to use the magic word precedent, that have said that good faith is indeed relevant? Should, if we were to follow that route, shouldn't this case be remanded to the trial court for a determination whether the good faith of the tobacco company was indeed proper here, et cetera, et cetera?
Justice Kennard, the correspondence that you're referring to occurred after all the events at which sampling, over which we sued.
So
that's one.
This is where
chronologically, I was just going to make that point.
Yeah, but may I ask clarification then? Because
certainly,
according to my notes, it said that the letters were exchanged in, I presume, early November 99, pertaining to an upcoming plan.
That's correct. Typically at the Pomona Raceway, uh-huh, which is a public property, Los Angeles County Fairgrounds, there is an event, a National Hot Rod Association event in February, which is the February 99. We sued over that one. There was another one scheduled in mid-November of 1999. The interchange of correspondence occurred before the November 1999 event.
Right.
All the events over which we sued had occurred before November of 1999. The last event was the Del Mar Fairgrounds Motorcycle Championship, which is, I believe it was Justice Chin asked me the question. I indicated we didn't find out about that event, which occurred in October of 1999, until 2 years later when we did discovery in our case. So there was an event in November of 1999. We knew that was upcoming. My conversations with R.J. Reynolds dealt with whether or not they would sample at Pomona, which was public property. There are other letters in the record, which I have with me. I'm not sure I can lay my hand on the letter immediately. I had correspondence with an attorney at R.J. Reynolds called Mr. Thomas Rucker. We debated whether they could sample at all at Pomona. The debate was, we won't sample, we won't provide, distribute free samples, free cigarettes at Pomona in November 1999, because we understand the Attorney General takes a position that that would be illegal and a violation of statute. We never agreed that as to Pomona, public property, that they could do sampling so long as they placed their sampling activity within an enclosed tent. As to private property, such as the Sonoma Raceway, now called Infineon Raceway, which is on private property, our position under the Master Settlement Agreement, not under the statute, but under the Master Settlement Agreement with the tobacco companies, between the state and the companies, there are other restrictions that we're applying. The context of the discussion about the enclosed tent was primarily within the context of the Master Settlement Agreement, which says essentially that you can only provide free samples if you do it in an adult-only facility where children are not present. We argued that you had to enclose your sampling activity within an opaque tent where minors couldn't see. The open booths, which Reynolds had used at some of these events in issue in this case.
Counsel, what is the direct answer to the direct question?
I'm sorry,
are there triable issues of fact regarding good faith on the part of the defendant and delay on your part for which we need to remand this case?
I don't believe so, Justice Chen. I believe the record is clear. The court had before it the the evidence one way or the other, and it decided that Reynolds had not raised the issue of good faith in its summary judgment motion. And that, I believe that's the state of the record, and that the good faith issue, I think we've responded to that to the extent that the legislature decided in this case that $1,000 for the third and every sample after that was the penalty that was needed in order to deter this kind of conduct, which the legislature understood was very difficult to police, because we're talking about temporary locations where you give out free samples. For instance, Reynolds could set up tomorrow a booth out on the sidewalk in front of the Reading City Hall here and hand out samples. I mean, it's not, assuming that the court were to uphold or to say that the statute is preempted, that the sampling on public property is allowed. But it's very difficult to police that kind of thing because of the transitory nature of the sampling activities. The legislature decided we've got to set a high penalty here. We'll give a narrow safe harbor. Good faith, I don't believe in this instance, has any relevance to, it's a violation of the law. It's a strict liability statute. To carry on that example that I started to give about sampling on the sidewalk out in front of the city hall here, the distinction that the defendant and Reynolds makes in this case is that sampling is somehow different from a sale. As I mentioned, federal statute specifically says sampling is a kind of distribution. What if Reynolds were to hire someone to set up a booth out on the sidewalk in front of the city hall here and sell cigarettes for a nickel apiece, individually wrapped cigarettes? That's promotional. The convenience store, the gas station up the hill, is charging $3.39 for a pack of Camels. A nickel cigarette would be $1 a pack. State law, however, that's a sale. There's an exchange of money, a nickel apiece. That's a sale. The state law, however, forbids Reynolds or anybody else from selling cigarettes in packs of less than 20, or packages of less than 20. It's a violation of Penal Code Section 308.3. Okay, Reynolds' view is that that's perfectly appropriate for the state to regulate because it's a sale, but it's also a promotion. It's selling cigarettes at such a cheap price, individually wrapped, just to get people to try them. It's like those individual samples we get at the supermarket of sausage or ice cream or whatever that are being passed out on a regular basis to get people to try the product. So it definitely promotes. So the determinative factor here is not whether it's promotion. The determinative factor, as far as the state is concerned, is whether product is being transferred, distributed by a tobacco company to an individual consumer. That's the critical difference between free sampling and other kinds of promotion that do not involve the product itself, such as a brand name sponsorship, such as passing out lighters, T-shirts, caps, anything that promotes the product without involving the actual transfer of ownership from a tobacco company, which is the object of the statute here, and an individual consumer to obtain ownership of that product. I think that's the crux of our arguments. If the state can regulate where, when, by whom and to whom cigarettes can be sold and where they can be used, where they can be smoked. You can't smoke in this chamber. You can't smoke out in the foyer. You can't smoke in bars. And those are all legitimate regulations, but there are instances in which you could promote cigarettes by smoking. What if Reynolds is passing out cigarettes in a bar, which is an adult-only facility, and it tells its sales representatives to smoke? So that those who are smokers can smell that wonderful aroma of a Camel or a Winston. Completely illegal, completely appropriate for the state to regulate that, yet it's promotion. So the determinative factor, as far as we're concerned, is not whether it is promotional, but whether, at least in this case, as far as free sampling is concerned, whether or not it involves the transfer of product from one person to another. Unless the court has other questions, I can...
All right. Apparently none.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eckert. We'll hear from you by way of rebuttal, Mr. Escher.
Yes. First, Your Honors, I would like to address, what I would call the parade of horribles with respect to the argument that, that the Attorney General is making in connection with the use of the term promotion.
Before you go through the parade of horribles,
okay,
could you answer the direct question? Do we need to remand? Is there a tribal issue of material fact on the issue of your good faith and the defendant's delay, the Attorney General's delay?
The answer is yes, Your Honor, if you don't rule for us in connection with the two other arguments we've made, the preemption argument and the argument with respect to the compliance with the Health and Safety Code section. If you rule in our favor on either one of those issues, there's no need to remand the case because, of course, if the Health and Safety Code section is preempted as it applies in this case, there'll be no need to consider the good faith issue, but it's very clear that the Superior Court made a mistake in making the determination that that good faith was irrelevant to the issue of culpability, and they basically just begged the question, as the Attorney General has done here, in basically saying, well, because there's been a violation of the statute, then good faith is irrelevant on the question of excessive fines. But it's very clear from the U.S. Supreme Court cases and Your Honor's cases that that degrees of culpability are absolutely relevant to the issue of whether there's been an excessive fine.
What is your response, and I hope I remember it correctly, but I thought that on this particular issue, in response to my questioning, the Attorney General replied that in any event, this issue wasn't properly and timely raised in the trial court with respect to the summary judgment.
If I could address that, it was properly and timely raised, Your Honor. There were some somewhat unusual procedures in connection with this case. Both parties made cross motions for summary judgment on the issue of whether there was any liability. There was no real disputed issues of fact that we could see on the issue of liability. The judge made a determination on the liability issue against Reynolds, but recognized that he had not yet made a determination on the issue of the amount of damages in the case. We, at that point, we raised the issue of excessive fines in a timely fashion, and the judge indicated that he would allow briefing on the excessive fines issue, and we did have a hearing on the combination of excessive fines and the quantum of damages in the case. So the excessive fines issue was absolutely argued to the trial court judge, and Your Honors, I would note if you look through the record that there was no kind of argument by the Attorney General that we had waived the excessive fines affirmative defense, which we did raise as a specific affirmative defense, because we didn't move for summary judgment on that issue. Of course, we didn't need the excessive fines affirmative defense to try and prove our summary judgment case, which was either compliance with the Health and Safety Code section or preemption. So that's the answer, Your Honor. It was absolutely fully argued and litigated in the lower court, and the lower court made the determination that the degree of culpability was irrelevant, and that's what was erroneous.
And with respect to the exchange of letters between your client and the Attorney General, I'm sure that you heard my reading of a particular part of the exchange between the two parties. But I gather that the exchange of letters pertaining to the November 1999 Pomona authorizes, that event, I understand, was not included in the complaint that the Attorney General brought, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So would you be kind enough to, at least for my benefit, tell me why it would be proper, since the AG, the Attorney General, argues to the contrary, why it would be proper for this court to take into consideration the November 1999 exchange of letters between your client and the Attorney General in determining good faith?
I think the argument is, Your Honor, that it's some evidence of our good faith interpretation because the letter by the Attorney General is consistent with our interpretation. We're not arguing at this point that there's some sort of actual literal estoppel that we, you know, relied on that interpretation in connection with some action that we took that we're being punished for now, but rather that it's one of the pieces of evidence that is supportive of our interpretation of the statute. Because I think if you look at that letter, you certainly come away from the letter with the understanding that that compliance with this sort of opaque tent approach would be consistent with our legal obligations as somebody who's trying to do sample cigarettes on public roads.
And this was the first exchange or the only exchange that occurred between your client and the Attorney General, and nothing with respect to the events that did become part and parcel of the Attorney General's complaint that preceded the November events?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that factual question. That may be the first written piece of evidence with respect to that issue, but I'd have to go back and take another closer look at the record on that. But once again, Your Honor, we're not relying solely on that letter as some sort of estoppel argument, but rather on the whole course of conduct. And we, of course, reported all of these free samples to the state government as we were doing them in the course of 1999, and that the Attorney General is going to say, well, they didn't know that there were all these free samples being distributed, but in fact, the state of California knew because they were reported and taxes were paid on them to the Board of Equalization.
So just to clarify, it's your position that the Superior Court erred in finding good faith irrelevant and declaring the statute to be one of strict liability?
Well, I guess the answer to that is yes, Your Honor, although I guess if I go back on the issue of strict liability, it is strict liability in the sense of the determination of liability. I think it is inconsistent with the constitutional law on excessive fines to say that just because there's been a determination of liability, that the degree of culpability is irrelevant. So I think it is.
If culpability, if good faith were to be factored in and your client was found to have acted in good faith, how would the fines be calculated other than as the statute says?
I think that it needs to take all the constitutional considerations into account, Your Honor, and that the Supreme Court's indication in the Jakian case and others suggest that there's some discretion on the part of the trier of fact, but they need to consider the degree of culpability, and I would say that the number certainly should go down. $15 million is really quite a bit of money. And
so the Superior Court, according to your view, would not calculate the fine according to the number of violations. It would do something else impressionistically as to how much would be appropriate for your culpability?
I think that they could do it on a per-violation basis, Your Honor. I think that specific issue hasn't been decided, but I think that there should be a downward adjustment in the amount of fine to take into account the good faith issue.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, because this isn't punitive damages. This is statutory fines. So I'm just wondering how the Superior Court would actually implement what you're suggesting it should
right. I don't think that the law on this is fully developed, Your Honor. I think that borrowing from the law of punitive damages in this context might well be appropriate.
Counsel, if I could take you back to the difference in wording of the two safe harbor provisions.
Yes, Your Honor.
The subsection G that deals with private property open to public use speaks in terms of where minors are denied access to a separate non-sale distribution area. To me, that means a tent, or it could mean a tent, and closed to prevent persons from observing the distribution from outside.
Right.
But the other safe harbor provision doesn't contain that type of language.
Right.
And I guess
That's right, Your Honor. The other safe harbor provision doesn't contain that language, but remember,
You may respond fully to Justice Baxter's question, but your time then will be
okay.
Over.
Your Honor, subsection G was passed in the year 2001 after this issue came up, and it wasn't in effect in 1999 when the events in question took place. And our position, Your Honor, is that the separate non-sale distribution area is a way of making it more explicit and is consistent, Your Honor, with the legislative history, which states as follows, quote, "The language about public facilities leased for private functions suggests that booths, tents, or barricaded areas may be used for sampling if there is a uniformed guard present," end quote, and I'm reading from the Senate third reading from 1991. Our position is consistent with that legislative history, and our view is that subsection G makes it more explicit, but the difference in language between subsection G and subsection F is a result of the passage of time and the emergence of this issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Escher. Thank you, Mr. Eckert. The matter stands submitted.